This is the Homebrew Game Club, a podcast about modern, brand new, aftermarket video games for retro consoles. On this podcast, we pick one game a month to play and talk about. Today's game is Dungeons and Doom Knights for the Nintendo Entertainment System. My name is Nick, also known as D. Vertov, and joining me today is...
Bart, also known as Clever, username needed. Actually, I think that username's actually pretty clever now, so I'm not gonna keep looking for one.
It went from being clever to being like not clever, and then it went through the valley of uncleverness, and it came right back out, and now it's clever again.
I don't know. When I first got on Instagram, I saw all these people with like really clever usernames, and I was just like, I did it as a joke, like making fun of these dipshits on Instagram that were like, oh, look at my username. It's so clever. And I was like, clever username needed. And then like 6 months later, I was like, fuck, that's actually kind of clever. I'm one of them. I guess I'll leave it.
Yeah. Well, now that's your name now, man.
Crap.
It's clever. So usually at the top of these things, I do this little disclaimer where I say, like, you know, these, we just want to remind everybody that these games are not made by professionals. So we want to be a little soft touch when we come to any criticism and stuff like that. But I will say this is one instance where the game was actually made by a professional game developer. So
look out, we're going to rip it a new one.
Gloves off.
Oh, shit.
Gloves off. Here it comes. All right. No, not really. Okay. Dungeons and Doom Knights. A little backstory on this game. Yes, it was developed by Artix Entertainment. So I had never heard of these guys. They have been around for a long time, since 2002, in fact, 20 years. Founded by a guy named Adam Bon, who goes by Arctix Krieger pretty much everywhere. So it started out, it looks like, I played a few of their other games. And I think they started out as like kind of like a Flash-based gaming and mobile games of different genres. All of them have this kind of like fantasy theme, or most of them do. My impression is most of them work on kind of like a free-to-play, like freemium model. Yeah, stuff from like RPGs, MMORPGs, card games, action games, and they got like an infinite runner. So you're Arctix and you're running and you're just like slaying zombies, okay, like on your phone. So, many different genres. They all have the same kind of humor. Lots of making fun of tropes of the genre and things like that. And many, many references back to Army of Darkness. The guy really likes Army of Darkness.
I really like Army of Darkness. That's
cool. I mean, it's a good movie. It's a really good movie.
Hell yeah, it is.
So yeah, all of these games are based in this kind of extended universe, the same world as this game that we're going to talk about today. So Arctix was inspired to get into NES development after watching The New 8-Bit Heroes, which is a documentary about the guys who made NESmaker. And so he made a demo for the 2019 Bite Off competition. The Bite Off competition is I believe it's annual, and it happens, it's for NESmaker developers. There's actually one going on right now. But so he made a demo for the 2019 Bite Off and decided to get into, he wanted to make a bigger game. This is all coming from the supplementary materials to this game, the Pretendo Empower, which we'll talk about here in a minute. So the Kickstarter for this game launched on April 1st, 2019. That is April Fool's. Okay, it went on to raise over $54,000. So it was quite a successful Kickstarter, funded on its first day. I'm going to be honest with y'all. I did not back this game. I thought it was a joke, because it was launched on April 1st, and it looked like a vanity project. So sometimes, you know, people say like, I want to make a retro game. And so they, you know, they maybe commission somebody to make a game for them. Nothing wrong with that. It wasn't the kind of thing that got me excited. It looked like it was just going to be kind of a one-off joke game. There is a story about this in the Pretendo Empower magazine. Artix actually talks about how this seemed to make some established NES homebrew developers kind of salty. And so he decided to make this the best game that this is a quote from the magazine, the best game I had ever made, my 8-bit magnum opus. Okay. So it was a joke game that he ended up taking extremely seriously. So lots of press coverage around this game. and lots of credits on this one. So as you would expect coming from a professional developer, they did have quite a few people working on it. And I just want to say, notably, Mr. Dale Koop did the programming for the game. And I actually reached out to him. I'm like, would you consider this to be a Nestmaker game? Is this still a Nestmaker game? And he said, yes, it is a Nestmaker game. So Dale Koop, friend of the podcast, great guy.
Shout out.
Shout out. Yes. So, Bart.
Yeah. What? Huh?
What kind of game is this? Let's describe the game for somebody who has not played it before.
So, like, some people would say it's like Zeldavania, which is like, I guess, a cross between Legend of Zelda and Castlevania, which to me means there's kind of a giant open world like the Legend of Zelda, and you have to run around finding different weapons and power-ups, and sometimes you may have to backtrack to a place you've been before that you couldn't get to before once you get the new power-up, and you just kind of explore, and it's like an adventure game. It's exploration-based. There's a huge overworld map. You're a character that runs around with an axe, and you get, you know, like a sub-weapon every once in a while that changes the way you play. That's kind of the most basic way I could say it, I guess. Do you have anything to add to that?
Sub-weapons that allow you to progress to the next area. Yeah, it's a Metroidvania, but without the Metroid, it says with Zelda instead. You know, so yeah. It does have an amazingly large world map. I was really shocked to realize how large it is. There is a I didn't look at the magazine, the Pretendo Empower magazine, until I'd been playing the game for a while. But there is actually a world map in the magazine that, just like the old Nintendo Power, it looks like it's made up of like screenshots of the game, and it is impressively huge.
Yeah.
And that is just the overworld. That does not include all the dungeons that you go into. So
yeah, it really reminded me of that map that you would pull out of the Legend of Zelda box when you first bought it. That had,
yeah.
Well, although that map, if I remember correctly, it didn't have the entire map filled in.
Right.
It was just kind of like the beginning 2/3 of the game, and it was like, here's extra squares where you can fill it in as you go, which was, I always thought that was really weird. I'm not going to write on a piece of something that came with the game. Like, come on. Like,
oh, I've seen folks post theirs online that are just covered in like pen markings and stuff. You know, like bombing every single wall in the game, you know?
Yeah. I guess maybe even as a kid, I had the foresight to think that like maybe these would be worth something someday. Like there's always that section in the back of the instruction manual that was like notes, like in Super Mario Brothers, like you're gonna be like, hit this block and you get a star. Like, I'm gonna write that down in the notes. No, like, because I used to always hear from like my uncles and stuff, like, you know, your grandma threw away my comic books when I was a kid, and if I still had them, I'd be a millionaire. And like, so like, I'm thinking, well, what do I have that could be really cool when I was older?
There you go. Right.
And I thought, oh, maybe my Nintendo games. And then, so as a result, I never would write in them, or I never, you know, I try to keep everything.
Oh, man.
Just, you know, super pristine. And then, like, you know, I get to be 20, 25 years old, and nobody gives a shit about NES in those, you know, there was like that 5-year period where nobody was really thinking about it. And
probably longer than that, but yeah.
Maybe. Well, for me, it was a 5-year period, but I got rid of all my shit during that 5-year period.
Well, you had more foresight than I did. Like, I would get a new game and I would just rip the box open. Because it was like, I never kept the boxes. You know, it was like the boxes preventing me from getting to it. Because I didn't think about, like, well, that's a place you could put the manual and the dust sleeve or whatever the fuck it comes.
Right.
But no, I would just rip the box open, you know, and if I didn't want them, I would just toss them in the trash.
So I was like, the box looks really good on my shelf. And you were like, the box makes the pile of NES games bigger.
Right. Yeah.
You just basically got a pile of plastic cartridges on your floor.
Yeah. Well, I like when you get one and it's got, you know, I get a game off eBay or something, and the manual's got like passwords written in it. You know, I actually really enjoy that. Or it's got,
oh, that's cool.
I've got a copy of Tetris that has, it looks like it was owned by some couple who were like, or it might have been like a brother and sister or something like that, and they were writing their high scores on the inside flap of the box. Which, wow. I think is really cool. I like that. All right. So what are we doing here? Let me see. Yeah. So big open world map. Well, open world. I say it's a, it, so it has this, I call it environmental gatekeeping. I think that's what I'd say, you know, cause so you go into a certain area and like, you know, you can see a path and there's something on the other side of these big rocks. Right. But you don't have anything that will allow you to break the rocks. So it's like, you just have to make a note of that. You make a note in your head or you write it on the map or something like, hey, looks like there's a fountain on the other side of these rocks, but I can't get to it. And, you know, then you play the game and you keep playing and eventually you come across something that allows you to break rocks. And it's like, oh, I need to go back to that area, that kind of thing. Okay.
Yep.
So it does do this really interesting thing where it switches back and forth between an overhead perspective, which is in like the, you're playing in the overworld, which I think, frankly, the overworld reminds me a lot. It more than Zelda, it reminds me of A Link to the Past.
Okay.
I really got those vibes from it, but yeah, it switches from that overhead perspective where you're in a dungeon and sometimes it will switch to a 2D, like side platformer. Okay, well, I guess it's all 2D, but it's like you're looking at it from the side and it's suddenly a platformer. So like you, in the overworld, if you press the A button, you'll use your sub weapon. But, you know, when the screen shifts and it's a platformer, then when you press the A button, you will jump. And at that point, like your item, I believe, is up in A. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit, but that's a kind of an interesting thing to handle, you know, just perceptually just going back and forth between those two things. The plot of the game is, so you're destroying the Doom Knight. The Doom Knight is your arch rival, and you have to get powerful enough to confront him and take him down and slay his undead hordes and et cetera. Lots of comedy elements. Okay, so it's a very kind of conventional fantasy story, and then it plays on all of these tropes. So tropes, fantasy tropes, NES tropes, right out of the gate. You walk into a dungeon and you confront an old man and he tells you it's not dangerous to go alone. And then he steals your weapon. So it's the inversion of the old Zelda, you know, whether you get the sword, just stuff like that. So lots of throwbacks to NES, pop culture, lots of Easter eggs and Army of Darkness references.
Which I think that Zelda reference that you just said, when we played the demo back a year ago, maybe. I remember sitting down and we played the demo. And as soon as that happened, I was like, oh my God, I love this game. And then we kept going and something else happened. And I was like, holy shit, what is this game? This is great. And you and I played the demo and like got all the way through the demo. And we were like, I personally was like, when this game is released, we need to do this one for the podcast.
It does have a pretty good, robust demo. So if you're listening to this and you haven't played the game yet, you might want to check out the demo. The demo is pretty extensive, and I think it does give a good flavor of the game. Where can you get this game? The only place to get it right now is HeroMart.com. They are selling the cartridge, the actual NES cartridge. They have a really nice gray cartridge one, and then they have a super cool gold cart one for $100. It is a collector's edition. And then you can get the ROM. I believe the ROM, I haven't looked it up in a while. I don't have it in front of me. I think it's $14. So how did we play this game? I played it on a flash cart in my NES. So how did you play this game?
I played it using an emulator on my MacBook.
Did you use any kind of cheats or anything like that?
No, actually. So I'm going to be real upfront here. I'm trying to play this through as purely as possible, since I got chewed out on the last podcast for using save state.
I told you guys it's okay. I thought we decided that it's okay as long as I'm using save. I'm not using save states. You guys can do it.
No, it's fine. I'm just fucking with you. I just but seriously, I am trying to play this game through as purely as possible, and as a result, I have not beat it yet. I'm okay. Somewhere in the pyramids levels, but I am really digging it. But the the emulator, I played using the MacBook Pro and my little Super Nintendo looking controller, and I have not used any cheat codes. It is easy to get lost, and
well, yeah,
you know, that as a result it's taken me a little longer to play than I thought it would.
We can get to that,
plus with the time that I've, you know, been putting into it, it's just taken a while, but I do plan on beating it because I do love this game.
You have been chipping away at it pretty diligently. We've been checking in every weekend, and
yeah.
So I played it on my flash cart, and I did beat it all the way through, and I got all three endings. And I did use save states in a couple of parts, just where I didn't want to go back, and like I wanted to try a little something different for the podcast, and you know, like I'm crushed for time here, but for the most part, I did not use safe states at all. I didn't really think that it needed it. We'll get to this, but I think the penalty for death is pretty low. So, you know, you don't, if you die, you just kind of usually go back a couple of screens. So,
yeah. Yeah. So far, I'm not feeling like it's needing save states. It's just the thing that it needs the most is time.
Yeah.
Right. Cause just like you said, there is that, what did you call it? About the gatekeeping.
Oh, I called it. Yeah. I think of it as like environmental gatekeeping.
Okay.
I guess you'd say it's like literally a gate or something like that.
Right.
Just the way that the map is constructed. Like you can't get through until you have a key, and the key is some item that you have to go find or some quest that you have to go do to unlock that area. You know,
you're not a true Metallica fan unless you started with Master of Puppets. that kind of gatekeeping.
I can't get into the record store to get the extra heart container because this asshole says I have bad taste in music.
Ah, crap.
Okay.
So, yeah, I just, but that kind of stuff. And because I typically don't play a game like this with a notebook, because I do prefer, like, I don't think I've ever played a game and, like, kept notes of, like, oh, yeah, up by the castle to the left, there's like two skull tiles that I think I could break through once I get a special item that lets me break through it. Like, I never write that kind of stuff down. I usually, like, once I get a new item, I go and explore the entire map again.
Okay.
Which also helps me to know the map.
Okay, sure.
I guess by exploring it multiple times, which I guess, I don't know if anybody plays the way I described it in the first way by taking notes and stuff. I just, how do you play it? Do you do it the same way?
So, no, I kind of do. If it's a Metroidvania, I kind of play it the same way you're talking about. Like, I'll go back and forth all over the map. And, you know, because that's, to me, like, if you're playing a Metroidvania, it's all about learning the map.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. So, yeah, I do that. I just see that as part of the game. You know, and that's part of the fun to me is like, oh, where is this thing? Where is that? You know, I need to go this direction or whatever. I will sometimes take notes if I don't have a map. Yeah, I kept referring back to the map and the Pretendo Empower because I do need some kind of map, you know, and if the game doesn't give me one, then I will sit down and try to sketch one out. Now, several people who started this game told me that they had gotten lost. Like before I started it, that was one thing I heard. I really liked the game, but I got lost at this part. So I thought it was going to be, I started taking notes as if it were like a dungeon crawler. Mm-hmm. And like, I have some grid paper here. I actually got this for, what was the game? Swords and Serpents. Have you played that on NES?
No.
Oh man, it is like an old school dungeon crawler.
Was it an original NES title or is it like?
Yeah, it's originally for NES, but it was, I think it was developed by Interplay. But it's, you are walking through a dungeon and it's like that first person thing where it's a corridor and then you turn a corner and there's a skeleton and, you know, it's like,
oh yeah,
fight, run away, use item, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it is, the maps in that one are amazingly complicated and you really do have to sit down with like grid paper and like map it out.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't want to get lost in this one. So I started doing a map like that and it took me fucking forever.
Yeah.
Then I got through the first area and I was like, well, that was easier than I expected. And I didn't feel like I was going to get lost at any point. So then I just like jumped in and yeah, actually, Matt Houston in our Discord was like, hey, did you read the magazine? And I'm like, what magazine? And he goes,
oh no.
So I pull this thing up. All right, let's go ahead and talk about this now. One of the things that I think really works about this game is the supplemental materials that it's included with it. So there is this magazine called Pretendo Empower, which if you can't infer from the title, is a parody of Nintendo Power magazine. And it is written, I think, very effectively, just like a Nintendo Power back in the day.
Well, it reminded me exactly of a Nintendo Power. It was awesome.
I think it really captures the vibe very well. And I think it's essential reading for playing the game.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you could beat it without the magazine, but it's clearly meant to be part of the experience of playing the game, is referring back to the magazine. So I don't know how long it's been since, like, if you're listening to this and you're an NES fan and it's been a while since you have picked up a Nintendo Power, or maybe, you know, you didn't grow up with an NES. The whole goal of this magazine was to like sell NES games, right? But a lot of these games were very obscure and they were hard. And I think that like some marketing people at some point realized the difficulty of these games is going to make them a tougher sell. And so they came out with Nintendo Power Magazine, which these games include like almost walkthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
Before walkthroughs were a thing, before GameFAQs, you know, you would get a Nintendo Power magazine and it would take you through like 90% of the game. And it would give you cheat codes and it would give you, tell you where like all the little secret rooms were and stuff like that. It's amazing the number of little secrets that the magazine would reveal. And so even today, people talk about how difficult Castlevania 2 is. I tell you, like, I didn't have any trouble with it at all because I had all this Nintendo Power shit. And I would just look at all the Nintendo Power shit and it would tell you exactly what to do.
Yeah.
I beat the shit out of that game when I was like 8.
Yeah, I had a subscription to Nintendo Power when I was a kid, as I'm sure you did too. And for me, when the new issue of Nintendo Power, that was almost like a guidebook as to what game I wanted to get and try next. I would read cover to cover every month. A lot of times I would have read the entire walkthrough before I played the game.
Yeah.
You know, which is what I did with the Pretendo in Power. I picked that up. I read it like it was an instruction manual. Yeah. I went through the entire thing before I even started to play the game. The thing I liked about it was that, like we talked about earlier, is that it had a map included. And there were points in the game when I wished the map was higher resolution so I could drill down and see exactly where I was. But also, it was actually kind of cool that it wasn't so high res because I could just look at it and be like, okay, well, the ice world is up there and the pyramids are down there and there's the purple thing that I died in like 6 times. And
you know, I thought it was as high res as it needed to be. That's why I say I like that it looks like they used screenshots from the game,
mm-hmm.
which is how they would have done it in Nintendo Power. And like, it gives you a ton of guidance on where to go just because you can kind of tell vaguely what's over there. But it's not so close up that it gives everything away.
Right.
You know, so you still have some impetus to go over there. And to me, it added to the sense of adventure because it's like, okay, what is this blob? I got to go check. What the hell is that blob?
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, it helped kind of get me exploring. You know, it added to the sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Other stuff that works. Yeah. So I think the world map just in general, I think works really well. And it really does have that sense of adventure to it. It is easy to get lost, but you know, you'll often, even when you get lost, you come across something kind of interesting. Maybe you find another heart container or another, you know, skull or something like that. Skulls are how you do your sub-weapons. But yeah, as you explore the map, you find different power-ups, you know, optional power-ups that you don't have to beat the game, but it does reward you for exploration. So,
no, I was just going to comment that I agree with Raftronaut that we need more skulls in this game because the skulls were very rare. Like I found myself later in the game at the point where I'm at right now, you know, hacking and slashing these enemies to get through where I need to go and getting coins when I've already bought the house. I've already gotten the backyard. I've already bought the key. Like I don't really need money anymore. At least I don't think I do. I might need it later in the game, but it's like, I don't need these coins. Give me the skulls because I need to send my little Pomeranian of death out and kill these guys.
Yeah, at a certain point, the money does become kind of useless. There's things to spend it on, but it's like you don't get equipment or anything like that with the money. So you, Yeah, I think another thing that works to me is the comedy.
Oh, yeah.
I think you run a real risk in a game when you put comedy in there. I think that this game is pretty funny. I really enjoyed it. And maybe that's because it is directed exactly at somebody like me who grew up on an NES and who grew up in the pop culture scene of the late 80s and early 90s and who was a big Army of Darkness fan. So it's like, you know, every joke kind of landed with me because that's where I come from the same background, you know. So I don't know if this game would be as funny to somebody who wasn't from that, you know, cultural background, but it does have just kind of an inherent silliness to it that I think is really appealing.
Right. So if you're out there between the ages of 38 and 44, boy, you're going to love this game.
Well, how can you not love a sub-weapon that is just a Pomeranian in armor?
Yeah, it's pretty rad.
Daimyo, the undead slaying Pomeranian, is the most powerful weapon on the NES now.
He needs his own game.
Needs his own game. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what else worked? I really thought the difficulty was really generous. I did not find the game particularly difficult. I thought it was kind of challenging in some parts, but because there's such a low penalty for death, you know, it's just going to bump you back a couple screens. It encourages you to explore, and it doesn't really penalize you that much if you explore a new area and you get roasted because you're only going back a couple of screens, and you know, you're not, you don't lose your gold or any crap like that. It just,
true.
It just kind of bumps you. It's like throwing you out the door of the dungeon, like get out here, you know, and then you just go back in.
I will say on the flip side of that, there were some points when I was getting my ass handed to me over and over and over and over again, and I couldn't tell if I just sucked or if I didn't have the weapon that I needed to get and beat it.
Right.
I wish there was a little more of that, laying it out there that like you can't get any farther if you don't have this weapon. Or yeah, it could take, for example, the fire level where you have to beat the dragons,
right,
or whatever. It's like the dragons have captured the princess, and it's like, no, actually the princess is the one you need to save from the dragon, whatever it ended up being, which was a really cool level. But I kept getting my ass handed to me over and over and over again, and like there was a point where I thought, God, did I miss something? Am I like here too early? And so I spent a couple hours just exploring the map and realizing, no, that's where I needed to go. Also because of the Pretendo Empower magazine, if you look at the screen that the map is on, it kind of gives you a like levels, you know, there's number one, number two, you need
right.
to go here,
yeah.
three, go here, right. four, go here. And by the time I got to the fire level, I had already beaten everything before it. So I was like, well, I guess I just suck. So I'll keep grinding at it. And I eventually, you know, beat it, but it was so satisfying when I did. Holy crap.
Was there a sub weapon that you had to use there that you didn't know that you needed to use or something like that?
No, I think I ended up kind of timing out the fireball of the dragon and just realizing that I just needed to get full health before I went in and just just beating the hell out of him. And I, you know, there was times when I would attempt it, like when I'd respawn, I'd have four health instead of seven or six or whatever I had. And instead of like going back a couple of screens and defeating a few skeletons and fully filling my meter, I would just like run straight in. So.
Well, I mean, you talked about that kind of gatekeeping where, you know, you go into a new area and you just get your ass handed to you because the enemies are super difficult. I feel like this game didn't do a whole lot of that.
That's the only place I found it so far.
Maybe I just didn't come across it, but I didn't feel like the game did too much of that. I don't really like that kind of gatekeeping. I think it's kind of cheap, but
no.
Right. But yeah, you know, another thing is that like after you beat a dungeon, the enemies don't respawn. Or like the hard enemies don't. They'll be replaced by like some super cream puff enemy that you can just walk through. But I kind of liked that. If you feel like you missed something, you can go back in and it doesn't feel like it's a you know, a slog.
Mm-hmm.
Then finally, you know, I thought the music was good. Nothing that really like stood out, but I think that's fine. It was never distracting. I think it just went along with everything really well. So I didn't have any problem with it. Okay, so criticisms. Do we have anything to criticize? For me, it's all just going to be nitpicking because I think the game is just really well made. And there were a couple of things. There is a little bit of jank, like that old NES jank. Like there's the hitboxes are a little bit wonky.
Yep.
You know, I see a little bit of like graphics glitches and things like that. But to me, it just like anything like that feels like authentic NES experience. You know, like if you're going to make a tribute to NES games and it doesn't have a little bit of jank, like it doesn't feel right. I don't know.
True. But there is a difference between a little bit of jank and the entire top half of your character being able to walk through a rock, you know?
Okay, that's fair.
That was an interesting one for me. It took me a while to figure out like where I had to stand to hit an enemy because like the axe starts out over the back of your head and then goes forward.
Right.
And if an enemy is like at the 2 o'clock position, sometimes I couldn't hit it because the axe will only appear behind my head at the 10 o'clock position and then straight out at 3 o'clock. And sometimes it just wouldn't hit it. And so like,
interesting.
You have to sometimes I would just turn around. And so the enemy was behind me. When I swung the axe went back and hit the enemy. And, you know, and then there's other times when you're walking across a map and you're like run into a rock, but the top half of your body will phase through the rock and you can just walk right past
it. Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's just lining it up, stuff like that. And it is, like you said, it's just jank and it's just nitpicking, but that's really that. And then some of the power-up stuff were the only two nitpicks that I really had so far in this game. So,
what issues did you have with the power-ups?
The big one for me was sometimes when it changes from the overhead to the side scrolling where you can jump.
Okay. Yeah.
There would be times where I would try to jump and I guess maybe I would accidentally hit up on the controller, you know, just,
oh yeah.
my thumb slips and I hit the A button, and instead of jumping across the thing, I would send out the special weapon and then I'd fall to my death.
Okay.
Or there'd be times where I'd be in there and I'd be like, okay, here comes a guy, I gotta hit up an A, and then I would jump instead of sending out the special weapon or throwing the axe or whatever, and I would just jump and land on the character and take a hit. That's the one thing that I didn't really care for as far as the power-ups is the, I wish there was a different button besides A to send out the power-up, even if it was just like hitting start or select or something. You know, I could take my finger off the D-pad to hit select to send out that just as easily, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting problem to have because you don't see a lot of old school NES games that tried to go from that overhead, you know, adventure style into a side view platformer.
Right.
That was one thing that I was going to mention. It just not so much as a criticism, but more of an observation that I think it's cool that the game did that. But there were times like it never entirely got, I never totally got used to it.
Right.
Your brain has to flip a switch and it's like, okay, suddenly, because you're always on a 2D axis. It's a two-dimensional game. But it's like, is that 2D axis like north, south, east, west? You know, am I going left, right, up, down?
Right.
Or do I suddenly have, you know, you go through a door and the next thing you know, it's like you can jump. And it's like now you have a vertical horizontal axis where like, you know, your character can actually launch up into the air. And it's like your brain has to like, it's like one of those puzzles where your eyes goes out of focus, you know, and you can like see the image like,
yep.
Your brain just has to adapt.
True. Or they could make the special weapon up and B.
Yeah.
Like your regular weapon.
Well, and that was it because they wanted to map it. I think he probably wanted to map it to the same key, right? Because it was on the A button on the overhead. And then you get into the side view and it's still mapped to the A button, but now it's up and A. I don't know.
Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah, like it's okay.
It's just a nitpick. And the other nitpick is with the bats. Sometimes you would jump. And like, instead of jumping on your arc and you hit the guy, you jump and then all of a sudden you're floating there as bats and you get hit.
Yeah, like, there were a couple of sections where it looked like it was built to be a platformer, but then you try to jump and you turn into bats. So there is a power up that you get at a certain point in the game where you can turn into a cloud of bats and fly. But that is one where I felt like the gatekeeping was a little bit like transparent because you can't use it everywhere. You know, it's like there are places where, you know, you go up to the edge of a cliff and you can't turn into bats. And then you go to a different cliff that looks exactly the same and you can. I thought it was okay. Again, these are all nitpicks. I did actually kind of use it as trying to find secret areas of the game because then I just started bumping up against everything that looked like an edge in the game.
Yep.
It's like, where can I turn into bats and where can I not? And I did find some secret stuff that way because it didn't look like there was anything there, I would suddenly be able to turn into bats and I'd be like, oh, there must be some kind of secret here. So, but yeah, it did feel a little bit kind of like that artificial gatekeeping. And there were areas where I just wanted to platform, but I would turn into bats instead or vice versa.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And the last real nitpick that I had was, you know, if I played this on the weekends, and maybe a little bit during the week, just, you know, here and there, whenever I could. But taking a week off of this game and then coming back and trying to figure out where I was and where I'm supposed to go, it took a little while to get back into the flow.
Yeah.
Figure out what
I was doing. You know, and I talked to Treat about this on the Discord. I think this is a problem with Metroidvania games.
Might be.
Because it's a game based around exploration and remembering little details about this huge map. And if you walk away from it for a few days or a few weeks and you come back to it, it's going to be very hard for you to remember where to go next. You know, and I've seen games handle this in different ways. Like maybe they have, you know, maybe there's like a list of like quests or something like that. Or maybe there's a character in the game that like points you in the right direction. And I don't know if they could have done something like that here, but I didn't really feel like there was anything in this game that would kind of get you back, like point you in the right direction after you've put it down for a little bit.
Yeah, and that, like you said, that's a lot of games. I remember playing Skyrim, and like if I took a month off from playing Skyrim and I come back and I'm like, oh my God, what was I doing? Where was I? Shit, maybe I'll just start over, you know? But something like Horizon, Forbidden West, I took a couple weeks off from that and I went back and played it, and like on the loading screen, there's like a little blurb of dialogue that's like, Aloy talked to person X who said they needed to go to location Y, and like, oh yeah, okay, cool, that's what I was doing. Like, that's a real simple way to do it on the loading screen for these newer games, but that's kind of tough to do on the old games, and I get it.
But it is a problem with the genre. I mean, like, I've never actually beaten Super Metroid. That's a confession. So I've never actually beaten Super Metroid. I've gotten most of the way through it, but then I would take a break and I come back and I couldn't remember where the hell I was or what I was supposed to do. And I'm just like, well, this isn't fun. And so I would, you know, I'd start the game over or something. And I've never actually completed it.
I completed that somewhere around 2002 or three. It was after I got married and we were living in our first apartment together. And like when we first moved in, I found this box that had been in my old closet in my old apartment, and inside of it was my Super Nintendo, and it had like Super Metroid and Super Mario and all this stuff. And I was like, oh man, you know what? I never actually finished Super Metroid. So I sat down and like decided to play it, you know, in the evenings, because we cut our cable cord really, really early, like 2003, 2004, I think, when Netflix decided to start sending you movies in the mail. You know, we're so old that I had to, you know, download my, got my streaming by mail, I guess. But it's funny, like after we cut the cord, I was looking for other stuff to do and watch. And, you know, I'd get 2-3 movies a week from Netflix. But once we watched those, I would be playing old video games. And so I played Super Metroid for, you know, 3 or 4 months and beat it. And like, that was one of the best experiences I ever had playing.
I know. Yeah. Everybody loves that game. I've started it and stopped it like 4 or 5 times, and I've just never gotten all the way through it.
Yeah.
I'm more of a Castlevania Symphony of the Night guy, so that's my of my top 5 games. So
That's funny. I played that game and I was like, this reminds me too much of Super Metroid. I better be playing Super Metroid. So yeah, I totally get that. It's just whichever one you come across first, I guess.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
One other thing I will say about the items is I felt like some of them were way more useful than others. So like if you get the shield, it's like a reflect spell kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. That and like the health power-ups, like I just spam those once I got them through the rest of the game. Whereas some of the stuff, like there's, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's the equivalent of bombs. So you drop like, it's some little...
Oh yeah, it's like a bottle.
Some little bottle, right? You get it almost like on a side quest, but... you need it to get through one part of the game, and then, as far as I can remember, you never use it again. Maybe I'm wrong.
I would try to drop it on enemies, and it just I would feel like I'd drop it in the wrong spot, and it would just sit there. And
yeah, it was too slow. I would drop it, and then the enemy would run off, and it would blow up.
Yeah,
I might have used it like on one slow moving boss at some point. I don't know, but I didn't really find a lot of use to it, and I thought that maybe because it was Zelda inspired, there might be something to blow up. So I just started like using it on walls all throughout the game, and I never found anything. So I just got bored and stopped. You know, I did that in Space Raft too, because there's a character in there that drops bombs, and I just bombed every single wall in that frigging game, and I didn't find anything until finally in the arcade raft, I found the bong room.
Yes.
That's how I found the bong room. It was so rewarding to bomb everything in both of those games. And finally, I got a secret room, and it was Chicken Bong 69.
Dad, what's a bong?
Yes. What is it? Yes. From the Space Raft episode. I was playing Space Raft with my 7-year-old son, and I found a secret room full of bongs. Yeah, after you collect all the bongs, one of the Space Raft guys pops up and says, Chicken Bong 69, and my son asked me, what does that mean? And I said, I don't know.
Just wait till my kids throw a bomb in my basement and find my secret room of bongs.
Do you have a whole room of them? Do they spell out bong on the floor? It's just like
I don't know, but don't come over here with bombs.
So I think this is my plea to homebrewers. Okay, if you're going to put bombs in your games, put bombable walls. That's what I want to see. I want to see walls that you can blow up with whatever bomb weapon that is. Okay. That's my request.
Cool. And now their reply is going to be, it's not a bomb. It's a glass jar full of magic potion. Or I don't know. I don't know.
No, I had this thing on Twitter a while back. You know, I made a joke about this. It's because of Seth Abramson list. I said, because he had all these like weird criteria for the games, the NES games that he put on his list. So I said, okay, on our top games, our top 100 NES homebrews, we're going to pick games that can either be defined as a visual novel or a management sim. The game has to be multilingual, and one of the languages has to be Esperanto. Okay, so those were the only two criteria I gave if you wanted to be on our top 100 homebrew games of all time.
Okay.
So I'm going to add one more to that. Okay, so if you're at home and you're trying to get on our list, I want you to write this down, okay? Must have bombable walls, Okay. That's, I want to be able to bomb every wall in the game and find shit. Okay. That's all I'm asking for. That's all I'm asking for.
Okay.
Visual novel and or management sim, Esperanto, and bombable walls. All right. Homebrew Game Club, top games of all time. That's what you need. All right.
If somebody sends me a game that's a management sim and Esperanto with bombable walls, we're going to cover it on this fucking podcast.
Oh, we're going to cover it. And we're going to talk about it all the time because it's going to be the best game ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Although a visual novel in Esperanto, I don't want to have to learn Esperanto. But it's multilingual, so I can...
Look, it's about... English. Yeah, it's multilingual. It's about the spirit of the thing, okay? It's...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, okay. This is internationalism. This is Esperanto, so...
Now watch them put in bombable walls everybody everywhere, but don't put a bomb in the game. Why wouldn't that be a big fuck you?
All right. On that note, I think we're going to take a short break, come back, and talk about some of the comments that we got from Discord and have our final thoughts on the game. So here's a little music break from Dungeons and Doom Knights. All right. So, yeah, just some comments that we got from the Discord. Raft or not, as you mentioned, wants more skulls. So does Bart. Matt Hewson had some good commentary on it, but he summed it up. It's between this and Always Awakening for NES Homebrew of the Year.
Awesome.
High praise. Treed had a lot of good comments. He liked the exploration in the world map and also he said the gold cart version. So he actually got the collector's edition. The gold cart. She said it looks fantastic.
Sweet.
He agrees with some of the criticism about the hitboxes. And yeah, platforming in tight spaces. That's another thing that I wanted to mention. So when you're in the platforming sections, sometimes if the platforms are like really close together, I had a hard time jumping through them. You know, so like I could never quite position myself exactly to where I like wouldn't hit an edge of the platform. That would happen a lot. I just had to keep jumping until I got through it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. He and Tree Rosmos also were both kind of confused by the bat's power up and where you can use it. So Arctic's Krieger actually jumped into our Discord and had a couple comments. I wrote that down, that Arctic's actually agreed about the bats. Yeah. So he was talking in our Discord channel about this game. I do want to mention that he put some ROMs, some bonus ROMs in the Discord channel. So one of them was a Kickstarter bonus, and it is it's called Pack Add-In, and it looks a little like Pac-Man. It's like a maze chase game, but you play as Arctics, and you run around in the maze and pick up, I haven't played this yet. What is this? Are you picking up skulls? Yeah, of course you are. Of course you're picking up skulls. Right. And then,
oh, that's where all the skulls are.
Yeah,
right.
They're in that game. The other one, which I haven't played either of these yet, but this looks fantastic, is Dungeons and Daimyo. You actually play the game as the Pomeranian. I cannot wait to play this. I guess I did wait to play it because I haven't played it yet. But I mean, as soon as I get a chance to like sit down with it, like I totally want to play this game. So this looks amazing. You know, I got to say, just another shout out for our Discord. Like, I really do love... So we put up a new Discord channel for every game that we cover, and every single time I have... The conversations in all of these have been really great. So, like, this is one where, like, Treed and other folks, like, you know, could not... They'd get lost or something, and so we'd... Like, I got in there, and I tried to help him through the game, and he did finally beat the game. you know, just based on like me coaching him, like where to go next. And, you know, I really love that people are playing through this thing with us. Kind of the whole point of the podcast. And I'm just really glad to see people, you know, enjoying it that way. So
I don't post a lot in the Discord, but rest assured, I'm lurking.
He's lurking, folks. So yeah, final thoughts on this game.
Dare I say it's my favorite game that we've played on the podcast so far?
Really?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
By that far. Doesn't really surprise me. I
No, it shouldn't. It shouldn't surprise anybody. If anybody knows, if you've been listening to this podcast and listening to how much I praise Legend of Zelda on the regular, if we play any game that is very similar to Legend of Zelda, I'm going to love it. And yeah, this is hands down my favorite game we've covered so far.
So as I said, I did not back the game on Kickstarter because I thought it was a joke, you know, and I am very happy to be proven wrong. I didn't back the game on Kickstarter. And in fact, I was probably not going to play it. I just had it in my head, like this looked like a vanity project. It looked like a joke. I decided to play this game. You wanted to do it for this podcast. And I heard other people talking about how great it was in our Discord. And I was like, okay, I need to check this thing out. And I am so happy to be proven wrong. This game is great. This is a fantastic game. It really does communicate that sense of adventure. It is a great homage to those classic NES games. And the, you know, the Pretendo Empower is a great homage to Nintendo Power. I think everything that it does, it really hits it. Like, it just hits it really well. It hits all the right notes. You know, and I reached out to Dale and I asked, is this really a NES Maker game? Because I just wanted to confirm that. Even when I think about NES Maker games, you know, they tend to be the first project for a lot of people. And, you know, many of them are not that deep. You know, I mean, they're fun, but they don't have that kind of like those extra layers that you see in some games. This one absolutely does. This is a very deep game. So much so that I had to reach out to him and confirm that it is, in fact, a NES Maker game. And he's like, yeah, it totally is. So I think, to me, this absolutely raises the bar for what is possible with NES Maker. I do agree. It's probably one of the best homebrew of the year that I have played for NES. It's fantastic, and I think it's a must play. It is a must play.
Absolutely.
If you're into NES homebrew. I
100% agree with you about the homage stuff. Like, this is, it's almost like a love letter to everything that made Nintendo great when we were younger. And it just feels like a huge nostalgia bomb all the way through, you know, because I opened up the Pretendo Empower and you see the logo and it's very, very reminiscent of the Nintendo Power logo, and even the art and just the way the pages are laid out. And then when you start actually playing the game, it's, I don't know, man, it was kind of great all the way through for me. I say all the way through, I'm probably through 2/3 of the way through, but I'm still.
But you know, even with it as a nostalgia bomb, as you said, I think that somebody who didn't grow up in that era would find a lot to enjoy out of the game.
Oh, sure.
Because it's a really well-made game. Like, it's made by people who have, this is not their first time making a game. Like, you can just feel it, you know? So, okay. Yeah. Again, Dungeons and Doom Knights, folks, you can get this at HeroMart.com. It's available physically on cartridge and digital download ROM. Go play it. You got to check this one out if you're into NES homebrew. That's our verdict.
Yep. I would love to get the gold cart version of this at some point.
You know, honestly, I've been thinking about it myself.
I'm honestly so in love with this game that I wouldn't drop $100 on a lot.
Yeah.
But this is one that I would. And that's, Artix, that's super high praise coming from me saying I would drop $100 on a
Bart doesn't really collect games. Like, I guess he's started to now, but
I have more Atari 7800 games than I have any other.
I've been looking at it too. Like, I had to confirm the website when I was doing the show notes, and I went back in, this is just a couple of days ago, and I'm sitting there and I'm staring at that gold cart collection, you know, and it's got like the foil, gold foil on the box. And I was like, oh, that's good. That would be really good on my shelf.
I would get that and I would shoot it like with my camera to make that thing look as good as possible.
Oh man. Yeah. Taking that, you know,
if somebody out there, maybe happens to have an extra copy they want to send our way, we would shoot some stuff for you.
Yeah. down to the photography studio.
Yeah, man. Or do some little motion stuff. And I don't know. It's pretty cool.
Just that thing, the gold cart under the lights.
Yep. Oh, it would just sparkle. Yeah.
All right. Dungeons and Doom Nights, everybody. Check it out.
Yes, please.
All right. Some news. Homebrew news. So there's a lot of game jams going on right now and competitions and things like that. So if you just kind of stumbled across this podcast and you're wondering, you know, how do I get into this scene? A great way to do it is to participate in these competitions and these game jams. So some of the stuff going on right now, as I said, the Nestmaker Bite Off, I think it's a Bite Off 3. It's the third time they've done this. But, you know, this is how Arctic started out. This is how a lot of people on this, whose games we covered on the podcast started out, is they've had games in this competition. That's going on right now. There are some super interesting demos that people have posted. And as we are recording, I think I did not look up the deadline on this, but it's all of these game jams and stuff. It's if you're listening to this in September or October of 2022, you're probably too late to enter these. But yeah, that's one that's going on right now. Another one, the NES Dev Coding Competition. So this is a big one. This has been going on for almost a decade now. This competition goes on off and on. I don't know that they do it every year. But tons of the games that we have mentioned on this podcast, originally demos for that competition. It used to be in the NES Dev forums, and then they made their own website, and now they've moved it to itch. It's on itch.io as a game jam. So it's NES Dev 2022 on itch. November 1st is the deadline on that one.
So wait a second. Sorry to interrupt. I'm just looking at the Bite Off website right now.
Uh-huh.
You can actually play these games on the Bite Off website.
Yeah.
Am I getting that correct?
Yeah, I believe so. Well, people are posting the ROMs as they're finishing them. So
that's really freaking cool.
Yeah. If you just, you know, if you want to try out a bunch of new homebrew ROMs, just check out that competition. And there's a ton of demos. I mean, some of them, John Vanderhoof and Rafternaut posted a really cool, it's like a sci-fi rhythm game. It's kind of based on Rez, but it's for NES. Mm-hmm. I really got into that one. I had a lot of fun with it. I think he's going to expand that into a full game. And that's another thing. You check out these demos, and a lot of times they do become full games. So it's fun to see them in their prototype stage like this. Like, I know Witch and Wiz was like that.
What was the one that they did? The Rez type one?
Do you remember what is it called? Jeez. Hold on. Let me look that up.
Oh, hey, there's one here called The Myth of Zayla. Wow, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, okay, here, I'm looking at the Bite Off page. So yeah, Dale Coop has a couple games on here. Rafternaut did music on like four of these.
That's awesome.
Like Crazy Group Trio is on here. Oratorio, that's the name of it. That's John Vanderhoof's game with Rafternaut.
Oratorio, okay.
Yeah, it's a very cool concept. I have not seen something like that done on NES before. I got to check out some of these other demos. There's all kinds of cool stuff on here.
Yeah, I got to look through these. Oh my gosh. These are
look at all these. Okay, so we're gonna put this in the notes for the
yeah, the Coffin Popper one looks really cool. Just judging a book by its cover, that's a really awesome cover. Yeah. And then I click into it, and it seems like a very Lovecraftian kind of thing. And I'm wow. All right, I got to look deeper into this stuff. This is really cool. I suggest you guys go to the link that we put in the show notes and take a look at it, because there's some awesome shit in here.
Yeah, I think you're getting to the point where a lot of these Nestmaker developers have been around a while, and they're really starting to push the boundaries of not just what you're able to do with that software, but with the entire platform, the NES.
Mm-hmm.
Other jams going on. So there's another GB Dev, Game Boy Dev jam. You look that up. It's a hashtag GB Jam. And then there is, in fact, a GBA jam, so a Game Boy Advance jam going on that ends on October 31st. I actually jumped. There's a Discord for that one. And so that is trying to get that Game Boy Advance community really going. That's interesting to see. I can't wait to see some of the demos coming out of those scenes also. If you're listening to this and you know of any kind of competitions or game jams for platforms that we haven't talked about, let us know, and we will talk about them on an upcoming episode, because we really are trying to expand outside of our NES bubble. We've gotten really into Game Boy lately, and I've kind of touched on Genesis, but we're really looking to expand. So shoot us a message on social media or jump on our Discord and tell us about it. couple new games on Kickstarter. I tell you what, there's one new game on Kickstarter, Forcebot. It's a Sokoban-style block-pushing puzzle game. That one is fully funded, and it ends on October 15th. The Kickstarter ends on October 15th. Forcebot, the developer for that, has posted in our Discord before. Seems like a really nice guy, and it's a cool project. So check that one out. Okay, questions from our Discord. Do you want to talk about barbecue?
Sure, I'm hungry.
Okay. So, on our last show, our last numbered episode, Alfonso, we got a question in our Discord about St. Louis cuisine. What is the best pizza in St. Louis? And we went off for almost 30 minutes about St. Louis food. The one thing that we forgot to cover was barbecue, which is pretty funny because, you know, that is a thing that Missouri is known for, is its barbecue meat. So Rafternot asked, who has the best barbecue in St. Louis? And I got to tell you, folks, so right now we have a man here who is an expert in this kind of thing. Bart Elfrink is a guy who knows how to handle his meat.
Yes.
I'm actually curious to hear what Bart has to say about this, because he is somebody that I personally consider an authority on this particular topic. So who has the best barbecue in St. Louis?
Gosh, I think Bogart's has the best barbecue in St. Louis.
Okay.
It's in Soulard, Bogart's Smokehouse. They have some of the best barbecue you will ever have. Their pastrami is fantastic. Their burnt ends are fantastic. There's one thing that you could never get on the menu, which is their chicken wings. I've had their chicken wings, but it's only like... If Taste of St. Louis, if you go to their tent and he makes chicken wings for that, or also if there's a huge line outside, sometimes he'll come out with a big giant basket full of chicken wings and give everybody a chicken wing that's waiting in line. And it's a crying shame that he does not put those on the menu. They might be on the menu now, but I haven't seen them on the menu, you know, the whole time that I've been going to this place. That's a fantastic spot. I typically don't care for pulled pork.
Oh, really?
At any restaurant in St. Louis, because I make pulled pork at home better than. And that sounds so pretentious of me. I make better pulled pork than anybody in St. Louis. But for my taste, I like my pulled pork.
Well, it is amazing. I've gone over to your house. You're like, hey, come over. We made barbecue. And you just lay down this slab of meat on the table. It covers the entire tabletop. It's just an incredible amount of meat. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's getting ridiculous. And also, you know, I've gotten pretty damn good at making ribs too.
Oh.
But I will say Pappy's has the best ribs in town that I've had. And I'm sure there's other people that will disagree. And if you know of a place that has better ribs than Pappy's, by all means, put it in the Discord and I'll go try it. And I'll update this conversation.
Yeah, I would say later Pappy's episode is probably the most famous barbecue spot in St. Louis.
Yeah.
It's one of those like Food Network featured kind of things. But yeah, I mean, it's legit. They're extremely good. I always like Sugar Fire. I thought they were pretty good. They've been franchising, and so they've got different locations all over the place now. And I've had like some of the franchise locations are like hit or miss.
Yeah, it's mostly miss for me. I think Sugar Fire was awesome when they had like two locations, yeah, or one location, even back when it was only on Olive by 170. Like, it was so good.
Oh yeah, that's what I always go to. Right. Well, see, now we sound like barbecue hipsters. I know it.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, they were good back before they got famous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of were, though. You know, they were better.
Yeah. It's like Soul Taco. Soul Taco is delicious, which is a Korean taco joint in St. Louis that was infinitely better when it was just in its tiny little walk-up spot on the other side of Del Mar from where it is now.
It is not as good as it used to be. The last couple of times I got burritos from there, I've just been like, eh.
Yeah, I love their burritos. They are good, but man, right now they're sitting at like a 7, 7.5, where they used to be 10 plus.
Yeah, they used to be a straight 10. And man, you talk about snobs. I living in San Francisco, I was a friggin' burrito snob. Like I had very strong opinions about burritos. The Soul Taco burritos were 10s. I'm telling you what, just to get a burrito that good in St. Louis, a Korean burrito, It's still one of the best burritos in town, but it doesn't have any competition. You know, we're in St. Louis.
Very true. But also, I don't let that discourage anybody that comes to St. Louis from seeking out
Soul Taco and
trying their burrito.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's so good.
No. A bulgogi burrito with fried egg and extra kimchi. I'm telling you what. Whew.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. That's the one thing that could take me away from talking about barbecue, is talking about Korean barbecue.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Different kind of barbecue.
Korean food is my favorite cuisine, like hands down. Yeah. Oh man. I'd say Bogart's for their pastrami and their turkey and their brisket, but and burn ends, but Pappy's for ribs and my house for pulled pork.
All right. Bart's house, everybody. That's where you go if you like pulled pork. Yeah. And I mean, if you're not from US, we have different regional barbecue is a big thing. Like it is a thing that people will get into fights over. Okay. So it's different regions, different parts of the United States have different traditions for their barbecues. So Missouri, where we are from, Kansas City area, I believe it is the best type of barbecue. But it tends to be very, maybe you could describe this better than me, but I mean, I would say Kansas City style tends to be it's mostly the sauces are the difference between these different regional styles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love Kansas City style.
Yeah. Kansas City it's sweeter. Yeah. It tends to be sweeter. How would you describe it?
I think so. I think that's right. If I lived in Columbia and I had to make a road trip to go to get barbecue, I would go to Kansas City every time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
For those that don't know, Columbia is halfway between Kansas City and St. Louis.
Yeah, well, it's got much better. I mean, our barbecue here is just a knockoff of Kansas City style barbecue. But I mean, that's nothing wrong with that.
That's a hot take.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I know. I worked on set a couple weeks ago with a guy, an actor that came up from Memphis. And
not too dissimilar though.
We got to talking about barbecue, and he was like, "Oh, I don't know. I never had St. Louis barbecue, but it'd be really hard to beat Memphis." And I was like,
"How is it different?"
I think Memphis is more of a dry rub kind of thing.
Is it? Okay.
I've never actually been to Memphis.
Really?
I drove through it once on the way to Nashville to get hot chicken.
Well, maybe I need to go down there and try some barbecue because I don't know.
I would love to.
Any barbecue I've had in that area just tasted like St. Louis barbecue to me, but okay.
Oh, okay. I've never been down there, but from what I gather, it's like more of a dry, smoky kind of rub.
This is also a kind of topic that people will have really strong opinions about, that I think people who aren't from the U.S. would be like, it all tastes the same to me.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's like going to Texas. Texas barbecue is fantastic, but like they're all about the brisket.
Yeah.
I think the brisket's like my least favorite of all the meats.
Yeah, I don't really get the love for brisket. We had a restaurant out in San Jose, which, man, if you want to try shitty barbecue, just drive around California.
I don't know, man. There was a place in LA called the Boneyard that was pretty damn good. They did a really good try to.
Okay. Maybe there's a couple good places. I don't know. But anytime I had somebody tell me they had some amazing barbecue restaurant in California, I'd try it. And it was just like, this is shit.
Right.
No, but brisket, I don't know, man. I'm not too into it. But, like Texas style barbecue is fine. It's okay. It's spicy. You know, it has a spicier sauce, but it's just, oh man, it's all right.
I do like the sausage that you can get at the Texas barbecue joints.
Yeah, they usually have good
That's
sausage.
That's really good. Right. And brisket, I will be perfectly honest, brisket in Texas is fantastic, but trying to get brisket up here, they do it way better in Texas. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's our barbecue discussion. Do we want to do one more of these questions?
Yes. Why not?
Okay. So another one that we got that I wanted to go ahead and answer here. So somebody asked, what is the origin of the name Divertov? So that is my online handle is Divertov, D-V-E-R-T-O-V. So that comes from, if you go back all the way and listen to our original intro episode I did for my bachelor's degree in college, I studied filmmaking. And so I was a movie snob. And I really like foreign films and indie films and the kind of films that were made by like one person sitting in a closet with a camera and I don't know, just all kinds of weird artsy shit. Yeah, so I created a Twitter account I was going to a lot of film festivals. I was watching, movies, like sometimes really cool movies that I want to talk about, sometimes really bad movies that I wanted to talk about. And so I made a Twitter account that was semi-anonymous so I could just dish on movies, and I needed a handle. And so, Yeah, Divertov is a tribute to the Soviet filmmaker Ziga Vertov, which starts with a D. D-Z-I-G-A Vertov. And that is actually a pseudonym. So he was a pioneering filmmaker in the Soviet era. Like, he was very active in like the 1920s and 1930s. And he made a really fucking cool movie called Man with a Movie Camera, which kind of showed all the crazy things that you could do with film technology in the 1920s. And it's a lot more than you expect. And, you know, again, I've always been attracted to the idea of working in, you know, creative work that comes out of a heavily constrained environment. So, you know, that is why we're sitting here talking about homebrew games, right? Like, that appeals to me. Something like, mm-hmm. if you're given creativity with some very strict boundaries, what can you do with that? And how do you push those boundaries? That, to me, is a type of creative genius. That's where you really see who, like, the talented people are. And Man with a Movie Camera is a great example of somebody working in an era where you had a technology that had a ton of potential, but it was very limited in so many ways. And he pushed it in ways that nobody ever had before. And I think watching that movie today, you know, get a version with a good soundtrack and watch that movie. It's only like an hour long, I think. And you'll see like stuff that will just blow your mind. Like, how the hell did, you know, it's like today you just do it on a computer in like 2 minutes. But back then it was like, how the hell did he do this? Just like crazy tricks in camera, you know, just crazy editing, really impressive stuff. And so that's where the handle comes from. It's a tribute to Ziga Vertov, the Soviet filmmaker. One of my favorite films of the silent era. Yeah, and I made this Twitter account so I could like dish and just talk about indie movies, some of which I liked, some of which are terrible. I got to tell you, man, some of the worst movies I've ever seen are like, the more indie you get, like the more likely you are to see movies that are only meant for like a tiny audience of people. And they feel homemade. And I, you know, credit to people who are just like, I'm just going to make a movie, and they just go for it. But sometimes, man, it just does not work. So
I think you could be more accurate to say sometimes it does work, because I think it doesn't work more often.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. And you're still the filmmaker, so I'm going to let you make that statement. But, but yeah, I mean, God damn, I'm telling you what, some of these, I'd go to these festivals and I would sit there for an hour and a half. I didn't want to walk out. You know, I didn't want to walk out of these. Like, I go to a festival and there's some like movie that like the guy's whole family's sitting in the audience. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah.
I'm watching the fucking movie and it's like, I don't want to get up and walk out, because I know the filmmaker's like sitting there in the back of the auditorium. And it's like, I don't want to offend the guy, because I think it's cool that he made a movie, but God, his movie sucks shit.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, the worst fucking hour and a half of my life. Like, watching some of these goddamn movies. It's like, Jesus Christ. Anyway.
That's a standing rule at Sundance, as a person that works at Sundance and has for a decade, that you don't talk about the movies in any way,
really,
when you're in the theater, or, you know, because like, you could be sitting there and just be like, oh my God, this E.T. movie was a piece of shit. Not that it was, for the record, I fucking love E.T. I'm just saying this as an example. You know, you're just like, God, look at that stupid long-necked alien with the giant eyes. How dumb is that design? The stupid kid that cries on command, whatever. This whole movie is dumb. And then, like, as you say the word dumb, you turn around to pick up your jacket and you're 6 inches away from Steven Spielberg, who's been sitting behind you the entire time listening to what you're saying. It's like, you can't do that. You know, like, one day we were at this is way back in 2010, I think, we were sitting at a Chinese restaurant talking shit about a movie. And my friend of mine was like, oh man, I hated the main actor in that movie, and I hated every other movie that he's ever been in. And I get up to go get more Chinese food, and that actor was two tables away from us. And I don't know if he heard us or not, but I was not going to approach this guy ever.
Wow.
Because, man, how embarrassing was that? You gotta really be careful what you say and where, because you literally could turn around and Tom Cruise is on the elevator with you. Mm. You know, it's just ridiculous. Not that he ever was.
Well, and like, to me, it's like, if Tom Cruise knew that I didn't like his movie, like, I'm not in the industry, so I don't give a shit, you know. But like, I feel bad. Like, some of these, if I go to like an indie film festival and I hate this movie, I mean, like, you know, I'm really going to hurt somebody's feelings. Yeah, a lot of these, maybe they're not a professional. Maybe they, you know, they're not a professional filmmaker or something.
Well, you know, that's true. And then another another guy who had been at the festival like three or four times on other people's movies. He made his film for the first time, and it premiered at the theater that I worked at, and he was sitting in the back row, and I would say 10 minutes into the movie, like six or seven or eight people get up and just walked out, and he came out and he's like freaking out. He's like, people are walking out of my movie. I don't, what is wrong with my movie? You know, he's like talking to his friend, and I was just standing there and I was like, dude, if people get up and walk out of your movie in like the first 5 or 10 minutes, typically that means they want to buy it because they're trying to get ahead of whatever.
That's right.
That's what I just, I told him that because from experience, that's what I know. You know, if like three or four or five people get up, especially if one person gets up and walks out of the theater and within 30 seconds, four, five, six people get up and leave, it's probably a good sign, you know, and it turns out his movie did get bought and it did do really well. I'm not going to say who it was, but like that's very interesting. You know, you might think that everybody hates your movie and walking out, but when on all actuality, they fucking love it. And they're going out to like make calls and like, we got to pick up this movie right now. Cause there's other people in the theater that want to.
Well, watch. And I mean, you know, maybe that's true. Like Sundance, kind of, you know, cause that's kind of the whole, that's
it's true.
Point Sundance. Of some place yeah, that's, like Sundance. I'm thinking like,
sure.
Like a tiny local independent film festival. You know, if people are getting up and walking out, it's...
Oh, yeah. People get up and walk out.
Probably because they don't like it.
Exactly. Yeah. People are getting up and walking out at, like, SLIFF, the St. Louis Film Festival. Yeah.
I mean, I've had the most awkward one. We went to, like, a midnight show, and it was some... it was a Japanese movie. And it was... it had the best 2 minutes I've ever seen in, a horror comedy movie. But like, and I mean, people were just dying laughing, and it was so good. But then the titles rolled and the movie started up and the laughter just kind of died down. And it became really obvious to everybody in the room that the movie was not intended to be a comedy.
Oh no.
And it was a terrible movie. It was so bad. And what people had been laughing at is just like the janky cheapness of it all. But that wasn't like intentionally bad. It was like sincerely trying to be like, you know. And so finally, like the whole audience just sitting there in awkward silence throughout the rest of the movie. And the movie ends and everybody's filing out. And there was the director who had flown in from Japan. And he was just standing there like smiling and like waving and nodding at people. And I'm looking around and everybody is trying not to look this guy in the eyes.
Whoops.
Like everybody's like staring at the floor or like just staring ahead or something like that. And I felt so bad for the guy.
Yikes, yikes, yikes. But I mean, you know, when you make something like that, you gotta be prepared for that kind of crap. And also, you know, like they say, if you believe the good reviews, you gotta believe the bad ones. So maybe just don't read reviews, but you can't. It's really hard to have an instant feedback from an audience like that. With, oh my God, that's my fucking nightmare.
Don't read reviews. But you know what you should do? You know what you should do is listen to podcasts about your video games because they are great. Yes, always. Okay, so that is where Divertov comes from. It is a Twitter handle that I created as an homage to Jigga Vertov, the Soviet filmmaker, in order to enable me to dish on indie movies that I've seen that I did not like at film festivals. And that Twitter account has been through different iterations over the years. For a while, I posted about sports, which is stupid. But yeah, I started posting about video games again a few years ago, and that's where we are today. So, all right. Okay, the last little bit of news I want to talk about. So speaking of podcasting, our first anniversary is coming up real soon. We launched our...
We've been doing this for a year?
Episode 0, that's right, launched on November 1st of 2021. We have two contests coming up here in October of 2022 as we are recording. We are going to be giving away two of our very fancy pint glasses, our Homebrew Game Club pint glasses. We're going to do one contest on Twitter, and we're going to post the rules for that soon, and another separate contest just for the people on our Discord. We're going to have the rules to both of those coming up here in the next couple of weeks, so follow us on both of those places if you want to enter those contests. All right, the next game for the Homebrew Game Club will be... It's going to be two games.
Plot twist.
We're going to do two games. That's right. So these are shorter games. They are for Game Boy. One of them is Traumatarium, and the other one is PhobosDare.gb. Both of these are GB Studio games. They are quite short. Traumatarium is a... This is what I wrote down. As I was trying to describe this game. This is a gothic dungeon crawler with visual novel elements and simple JRPG... Yeah, JRPG style combat. So it is a small game. It is all about the atmosphere. So,
and it's like nothing I've ever played before. Like the actual mechanics of the game. I'm digging it so far. But we'll talk about it next month. But
it is a very interesting take on a dungeon crawler. So it's not quite like anything that I've played before either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's got some great atmosphere. Really cool art. You can find that on itch.io for $2. Okay. It did have a limited physical release. I think he only made 45 copies of that, but it sold out. I got one. So, but yeah, I don't know if he's going to do another physical release at any point in the future, but you can get the ROM on itch. The other game is PhobosDare.gb. This is one that I saw. It just concluded a physical release from Limited Run Games, which is how I found out about this game. I had not heard of it before that. I did play through this one already. It is very hard to categorize. I would generally call it a platformer. It has a lot of side quests and other scenes that kind of touch on many different genres. So it is a very meta game. It knows it's a game. Okay. So that's something to think of. It is horror. It reminds me of like a David Lynch movie, you know? So like a movie like Lost Highway or Mulholland Drive, where you're not really sure what the hell the plot is, but you just got to kind of like piece together all these contextual clues. And this is from the description. It's like a haunted Game Boy game. So it's like you pick up this game and things are not what they seem. Yeah. The physical of that is, it will be done by the time this podcast goes live, but you can get it on itch.io for $3. So both of these games together are pretty cheap and they're pretty short. So go ahead and play them. We decided to pick two spooky games again for Halloween. We tried to do this with Dead AS last year, but we did the timing all wrong. So Dead AS didn't come out until like January. But so I think this is going to be a theme every year for around Halloween for our October episode. We're going to do,
yes,
we're going to try to do like a scary game, or a spooky game, right? So
yes. So if somebody's out there and they have an idea for the scariest game ever,
homebrew game. Right.
Get it made. Yeah. Homebrew. Get it made before next year and maybe we'll do it. Do it next year.
Right.
Please scare the pants off of us.
Scare the pants off of us, folks.
Is it Traumatarium or Traumatorium?
Traumatarium.
Ah, crap. I've been saying it wrong this whole time. It's like a vomitorium, I guess.
Traumatarium. Vomitorium. Yeah. No, at no point did I vomit while playing the game.
Okay. Well, that should be the goal for whoever's making the scary game to scare the pants off of us. Make us puke.
Make us puke.
Not really.
Okay, this has been the Homebrew Game Club podcast. You can find links to our Discord, back episodes of the show, or other social media at homebrewgameclub.com. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HBGameClub. If you like the show, please help us out by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or by telling all your retro gaming friends about our podcast. If you have comments or a suggestion for a game that you'd like to hear us talk about, or you have like a question that you want us to talk about on the podcast, like what's your favorite barbecue? Actually, don't ask that because we already answered that one. But some other question, get on our Discord and tell us about it. Or you can email us at homebrewgameclub@gmail.com. Our opening music is by Twee. You can find him on Twitter at TUI2A03, where you can also find a link to his SoundCloud. Our outro music is by Raftronaut, and you can find him on Twitter at 0000Jordan. You can follow me, Nick, on Twitter, Instagram, or Video Game Sage at DVertov. That's DVERTOV. Bart is on Instagram as Clever Username Needed, no spaces. And Connor, who was not here today, is on Twitter at CONORNASH, also no spaces. Tune in next time to the Homebrew Game Club, when we will be talking about Traumatarium and Phobos Dare. Thanks for listening.
Alexa, make an announcement.
What's the announcement?
Could somebody shut the dog up? I'm recording a podcast down here. Thank you.
Announcing.
Could somebody shut the dog up? I'm recording a podcast down here. Thank you.